feels weird to be at this podium and not to say, please join me as we stand and sing. Kurt, thank you for leading worship today. We have had a bit of moving around to do, Nate being ill and everything. And again, we lift him and those who are struggling with the flu up in prayer. The word of the Lord from John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. That can be found in your New Testament on page 80 in your New Testament. It's going into page 81. Starting in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water, that had become wine, by the way, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water well knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Thank you, Marla, for your thoughts on Martin Luther King Jr. this morning. While some in the 1960s, such as Malcolm X, wanted African Americans to attain power and voice through traditional means, through assertive, revolutionary rhetoric, using violence if necessary, Dr. King brought about reform through countercultural methods, lectures on peace, nonviolent demonstrations, and the unification of contrasting social histories, white and black. We hope that tomorrow you take time to reflect upon Dr. King's mission for racial unification and reconciliation. 100 years before Dr. King promoted racial harmony in the civil rights movement, Abraham Lincoln and other abolitionists began creating policy that sought to end the humiliating and humanizing social system of slavery, culminating in the 13th Amendment. I'm currently reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's biography of Lincoln, Team of Rivals. Steven Spielberg used this book in developing the characterizations of Lincoln, his cabinet, and the legislative discourse surrounding the 13th Amendment in his recent film portrayal of Abraham Lincoln. Goodwin's title refers to Lincoln's competitors in the 1860 Republican race, William Seward, Salmon Chase, and Edward Bates. They were his team of rivals. This morning, I want to place us as Americans in 1859, 1860, watching in horror as the country turns to turmoil surrounding policy regarding slavery. The person that we vote for in this election has a significant say in the direction that the country takes in maintaining unification in the country. Up against Lincoln was Salmon Chase. Chase was the very successful governor of Ohio. Edward Bates, he had 40 years of law and policy experience serving on state and national House of Representatives, and he was even nominated for the 1852 election for vice president. And then there was William Seward. William Seward. Seward was born into the riches of a political family, and he had the financial support of the New York political machines. He gained fame in the political world by defending slave William Freeman, who was accused of stabbing four white people. Seward suggested that the process of slavery creates insanity in individuals, the defense of insanity becoming popularized around this time. He stated majestically to the jury, He is still your brother and mine. Hold him then to be a man. Few white educated individuals made claims for racial equality such as this in the 1840s. Seward's well-spoken anti-slavery and pro-education rhetoric helped make him a senator in the 1850s and the front-runner for president in the 1860 election. Goodwin emphasizes Seward's celebrity, his lofty vocabulary, his charm. In contrast to Abraham Lincoln, a self-educated country lawyer from Kentucky, Goodwin plays on this contrast between rich and poor, educated and uneducated, proper and socially awkward throughout the book. Whenever she introduces the letters of a new character in the Lincoln saga, she almost always focuses on physical descriptions of Lincoln, how he walked with long, awkward, gangly legs, how enormous his feet were, how socially uncultured, even inept, especially compared to Seward, he was. Lincoln's political discourse differed from the more professional, polished speaking style of Seward and of other contemporaries. Lincoln favored anecdotes, humorous personal stories to traditional references to Shakespeare and Greek classics that Seward often spoke through. The commentaries Goodwin chooses to feature consistently focus on Lincoln's mood, the sadness in his eyes, the despair, the pain he often felt, especially throughout the Civil War. Goodwin suggests that Lincoln was a melancholy individual, not a depressed one, but nevertheless different from the cheerful, hopeful individual one seeks in a leader. Goodwin's description of Lincoln and telling of the upset of 1860, Lincoln's nomination over Seward into the presidency, that description turns our expectations of a powerful, assertive, warlike leader upside down, providing readers with a physically awkward, somewhat crass, unexpected leader of America, a president who brought our nation through its most trying time, national separation, and established revolutionary precedents towards social unity. The season of Epiphany celebrates the entrance of the light of the world. 2 weeks ago, we remembered that wise men followed a star to Bethlehem, found the Son of God as a baby, and worshipped him, presenting him with gifts of incense, gold, and myrrh. Last week, Landon shared that when Jesus was baptized, the heavens opened and the voice of the Lord spoke upon him. "This is my Son, with whom I love. With him I am well pleased." I want to ask you again that you open to the Gospel of John and glance through the first chapter. The Gospel of John begins on a similar trajectory, introducing Jesus with magnificent language. "In him was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." John the Baptist ramps up Jesus' credibility in the first chapter. "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." The following characters John introduces have a similar excitement as they acknowledge Jesus. "We found the Messiah," said Andrew. "We found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth," exclaimed Philip. "You are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel," Nathanael told Jesus. Chapter 1 concludes with Jesus saying, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." The stage is set. The one we've been waiting for, he's here. Our introductory characters excitedly thought. They remember the words of the prophet Isaiah. "For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not remain quiet till her vindication shines out like the dawn, her salvation like a blazing torch. The nations will see your vindication and all kings your glory. You will be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will bestow." You will be a crown of splendor in the Lord's hand, a royal diadem in the hand of your God. Their king, the one who will rescue them in battle and redeem the nation of Israel, has arrived. And then chapter 2 begins to subtly shake our expectations of Jesus. The setting, well, it carries a big social significance, a wedding. Weddings in the ancient world were 7-day-long celebrations involving entire communities, entire families. John introduces a new character, Jesus' mother, Mary, though interestingly she's unnamed in this tale. Though John avoids the character development of Matthew and Luke, he implies that Mary knows something deep about Jesus, a secret of significant impact. There was no more wine. This must have been some party, by the way. There was no more wine, and Mary turns to Jesus. The dialogue that John writes is Mary saying to Jesus, "They have no more wine." But the implicit communication is obvious. Jesus, do something about this. I don't know. Maybe Jesus is the convenient, awkward, unoccupied male who had the time and the space to run down to the store and get some Riesling. But again, Mary seems to know that he can do something powerful. The miracle Jesus performed that night was fantastical, was unbelievable. He turned 180 gallons of water to wine. For some perspective, most basic rectangular in-home freshwater aquariums hold around 180 gallons of water. It's a lot of water turned into a lot of wine. But the process through which Jesus performed the miracle seemed rather odd. He seemed indifferent, if not slightly distant, when Mary consulted him about the social problem, as if he had better things to do, or perhaps a better situation to unfold his majesty. "My hour has not yet come," Jesus said. Also, another thing I found peculiar about the story is that nobody informed the master of the banquet of this miraculous deed. I've got to be honest, if I see something indescribable like the disciples did that night, it's going on Facebook. Katie's tweeting about it. I would start an Instagram profile for the sole purpose of documenting what I saw. I'm going to have a hard time holding it in. But the secrecy of the miracle seemed important to Jesus, as the servants managed not to peep to those in charge. The good news from this morning is that Jesus is powerful, that he's able to turn water into wine, and for that matter, many average, menial things into creations of beauty. But it comes with a hint of wariness. The disciples expected their Messiah, as stated in Isaiah 62, to wear a crown of splendor. They expected their Messiah to save Israel like a blazing torch with thunderous force. They expected their Messiah to vindicate them in the face of their neighbors, perhaps exacting revenge for their days of exile, their days of persecution, of abuse, of trauma. There's something odd, though, about the way that Jesus presents himself. His agenda doesn't seem to be their agenda. Most kings are more than willing to boast about their powers and their claims, what they're going to do, but Jesus seems a little reluctant, bordering on secretive about the things he can do. The things that he chooses to be assertive about, as we read in the next story in John, clearing out the temple, the disciples are like, "That's the temple." Even the things that he's assertive about creates discomfort. We take a bit of a turning point this morning in our journey of Epiphany. We've invested so much hope into the season of Advent, awaiting the wonders of the gift to come. We've invested so much energy in celebrating Jesus' arrival in Christmas, in celebrating that things will be different because the light of the world has overcome the darkness through the first few weeks of Epiphany. We've expected William Seward, a wealthy, charming, good-looking man who, with exceptional educational credentials, political and military know-how, and a passionate, outspoken voice, ready to take on the tyrants of the world. Instead, we've gotten Abraham Lincoln. Don't get me wrong, Abraham Lincoln's a nice guy, and I guess he'll get the job done. But he looks so awkward doing it. We expect someone with an impressive resume, with a 5-point plan on how to unite our country and eradicate our evils, but instead we receive a country lawyer with limited political experience. We expect our leader to motivate us with impassioned political pleas that empower us and tell us how we can help change the world, but instead we receive stories, anecdotes, parables about people we don't connect with who live in different worlds. We still are hopeful. We still are hopeful and excited about the journey the next few weeks brings us as Jesus reveals more about his majesty and character, but are becoming increasingly aware that our epiphanies may not match our expectations of King, Messiah, and Holy One.